Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, April 11, 2019. Let the record reflect. Time is 3:36 p.m., 6 minutes late getting started. My apologies. We're getting to that time where everybody's running from thing to thing right now towards as things pick up here. We're going to try to knock out a couple things today, and we're going to start with who we have present. We have Senator Reinbold to my left, Senator Machicki, Senator Kawasaki, Vice Chair Senator Coghill, myself, Chair Schauer. I'd like to remind everybody, please turn off or silence your cell phones. We've got Kerry assisting with Senate records in the front, Taylor on the LIO behind us. We have three items on today's agenda. That's going to be an initial rollout of Senate Bill 100, naming Willard D. Dunham Residence Hall, Senate Bill 80, Initiative Severability, and we're going to get back into Senate Bill 32, Crime Sentencing Mental Illness Evidence from Rules Request by the Governor. We're going to go now with an initial rollout of Senate Bill 100, naming Willard E. Dunham Residence Hall by Senator Machicki. I'm going to ask Senator Machicki and staff to come to the table, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Peter Machicki, District O.
For the record, my name is Cheyenne Grimshide, intern to Senator Machicki.
Okay. You guys know the drill. If you go ahead and walk us through the bill, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just giving a brief introduction. My intern here is well-equipped to handle this bill, but what this bill does, Senate Bill 100, this I would have put by request. This is from the people of Seward, but sometimes when you say by request, it sounds like you're not supportive of the bill yourself, and I'm very supportive of this bill. I don't know how many of you knew Mr. Willard Dunham. He passed away in March 1st, but he was a great man. From the time just after the earthquake when he began efforts to rebuild Seward, which you know that Seward was wiped out in 64, he was the founding director of ABTEC and was served for 50 years from 69 to 19. He worked to bring the Alaska Sea Life Center to Seward. You know, he was just the proverbial mayor while he was served there as well, which is when I met Mr. Dunham. Just always put his community first, always put Alaska first. He was an amazing man, and he will be missed by many. What this bill does, it simply renames the Alaska Vocational Technical Center dormitory as the Willard E. Dunham Residence Hall. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll hand it off to my intern, Cheyenne.
Again, for the record, my name is Cheyenne Grimshide. Our office was contacted by staff from the Alaska Vocational Technical Center, also known as ABTEC, early afternoon on Friday, March 1st, in hopes that we could help them with renaming one of their dormitories after their founding director. They explained that he had become sick and they wanted a chance to honor him with building, with the building renaming before he passed. Unfortunately, he passed later that very same afternoon after that conversation took place. I had the privilege of working on this bill and learned what a wonderfully dedicated and hardworking, devoted person Willard Dunham was to Seward in the state of Alaska. He spent his life doing what he could to advocate and better the quality of life for his community. He entered the working world right after high school, working with the Alaskan Railroad before being drafted and serving the state and the country in the United States Army as a pharmacy assistant and the medic stationed in Fairbanks in the early 50s. After his service in the Army, he worked on the docks in Seward until the 1964 earthquake wiped out the docks along with most of the town. This led him to work full-time with the Department of Labor and the City of Seward, which he built up an impressive resume with community service and job projects. Some of these include the moving of the State's University Marine Science Labs from the Southeast Alaska region to Seward, finding a state site for the vocational school, working with Governor Keith Miller to get ABTEC off the ground, heading the Spring Creek Correctional Center project, and the building of the Seward Library and Museum. He also spent 6 years on the Seward City Council, 2 years as mayor, was president of the Seward General Hospital Board, Fish and Game Advisory Boards, Longshore Union Boards, served as Chamber of Commerce president twice, and sat on nearly every city task force, commission, and committee over a 60-year period. In all my discussions with ABTEC staff, the one thing that is reiterated more than anything else is that his passion for Alaska and his dedication to Seward. For 50 years, he spent as acting director of ABTEC. He was not just an advocate, but a historian, reminding his staff and students of the goals of the school and Seward itself. These are the values that Willard Dunham left impressed on those around him, and the values that ABTEC wishes to honor and remember.
All right, we're going to go ahead and open up the floor this time for questions for the sponsor of the bill. Committee members?
She answered every question.
I notice here that you have some letters of support from the community. Mm-hmm. Was there outreach also to his family to ask them, did they support and others? And then just because I think it's right to do due diligence, was there any opposition to renaming the hole?
Mr. Chairman, we did not personally, but the gal I talked with at ABTEC said that she was in contact with family, friends, and coworkers at ABTEC. Right. She said there was lots of support.
Mr. Chairman, I've talked to many people from Seward, and the community is excited about this bill, and you will all be, if it passes, you'll all be invited to the ribbon cutting when it occurs. Folks, Mr. Dunham was extremely beloved by his community, and we have lots of support.
Copy. Will there be free food would be the question you'd probably get from this building for most. Just kidding. Okay, copy. Other questions for the committee? Senator Kawasaki?
Thank you. Sorry, I was reading something else. But what, did the building have a name before, or was it just called the ABTEC Dormitory?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, it did not. I think it was just the Third Avenue ABTEC facility.
It's a terrible name.
It is. This is much better. Senator Ramble.
So I have a question and a comment. First of all, thank you. I got a history lesson today. I did not know this gentleman, and quite a man. Pretty impressive, so thank you. What my question to you is, I personally have a challenge with people being named after things in general. I just generally do, because I think probably one of my biggest issues that I have with that is a lot of people have no idea, and why them over somebody else. I understand this, but what I'm going to ask you is can there be a plaque that states on the building why it's him? In why this building was named after him. I just think, you know, for people that might come and go in the future, I think, you know, informative plaques are just critical.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, the plan is actually, they have a city donation fund that is going to buy a plaque that will go on the side of the building that hopefully does that exact same thing. States kind of who he was to ABTEC and some of the things he did with them.
Okay, anybody want to throw another question at her? Because so far she's batting 100. I'm having a hard time thinking of questions she's not going to be able to answer. Really well done, young lady. Thank you. I've seen no other questions at this time from the committee, so we're going to go ahead and open up public testimony. And we're going to start with, we have Kathy LeCompte, if I've got that right, from the Vocational Technical Center in Seward. Kathy, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kathy LeCompte. I'm the director at ABTEC. And yes, there will be food at the ribbon cutting, which is going to be held on September 27th. And as Cheyenne mentioned, the plaque is being purchased by the City of Seward, and it will explain who Willard was briefly and to remind all the students that come through the door to live a life of community service in honor of Willard's memory. He was an amazing man, and because of his efforts at ABTEC, hundreds and thousands of Alaskans have gone through ABTEC and been trained for work and have had good careers, and we continue to do that to this day, 50 years later. So thank you for your support of this bill, and I will answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Kathy. Does anyone have questions for her? Okay. Seeing none, I see no other callers online at this time. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. If you did not get a chance and you happen to be listening online and you would like to submit your written testimony, you can do that at senate.state.affairs@akleg.gov. It will get uploaded into the public record. This time I'm going to take a brief at ease. Senate State Affairs back on the record. Senator Machiki.
Yeah, I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. You know, for the public, anyone that may be paying attention, you're wondering, why are you running a bill to change the name of a building? The fact is it's a state building, and it's required that you run a bill. So that's why we do it for bridges of special Alaskans, and that's why we do it. Little bit of a conflict. Willard was a friend of mine. This was not my idea, but he was also a mentor, and he just provided the ultimate example of public service in the state of Alaska, and I'm honored to carry this bill, so thank you.
Thanks, Senator Machiki, and I'm going to go ahead at this time and ask my the will of the committee, Vice Chairman, if the will, could you move the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move the Senate Bill 100, Version A, from committee with individual recommendations in the attached federal fiscal bill.
Okay. Seeing and hearing no objections at this time, we're going to take it at ease, and Senate Bill 100 moves from committee and sign paperwork. All right, we're going to go ahead and get a rollout of Senate Bill 80, Initiative Severability, by Senator Birch. Senator Birch and staff, you are at the table, so when you're ready, go ahead and put yourselves on the record and proceed with the rollout, please.
I'm Kim Skipper, staff to Senator Chris Birch.
Chris Birch, Senate District M. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Affairs Committee. Thank you for hearing SB 80 on initiative severability. SB 80 seeks to ensure ballot initiative language appears before voters at the ballot box in the same is the same as the language circulated during the signature gathering phase, and to restore the legislator's important role in the initiative process. Alaska's Constitution details a very important right for our residents, the right to enact legislation through the voter initiative process. The legislation the legislature also has the right to enact legislation substantially the same as a proposed initiative, thus removing it from the ballot. Per our Constitution, some issues are off limits for ballot initiatives, and initiatives can only cover one subject. But while a cursory legal review of the language occurs before the Lieutenant Governor's certification, it has sometimes been the case that further review finds constitutional concerns with proposed language. In those cases, a party can file a lawsuit to force the issue through the court system. This can happen simultaneous to the circulation of signature booklets. Under current law, if a court determines that language is in a proposed initiative is unconstitutional and or severed, an amended version of the language can appear before the voters. This results in voters seeing a different initiative than the one that they supported with their signatures. Furthermore, if the courts revise or sever the language after the legislative review process, they deny the legislature its right to review the initiative as revised. The net effect of a court's severance is that an initiative can move forward to the voters in substantially different form than the initial version reviewed by the legislature. SB 80 would rectify the situation. Under the bill, if the court determines that the language in a proposed initiative is unconstitutional or severed, the lieutenant governor must reject the entire initiative petition and prohibit it from appearing on the ballot. Voters should be assured that language on the ballot has not changed from the language in the petition booklets supported with voter signatures, and further restores the legislature's right to review and enact substantially similar legislation to stop an initiative from moving forward. Mr. Chair, again, thank you for the opportunity to present SB 80, and I would appreciate the committee's support. I would note that Eric Felstad, who has assisted us in this effort, is online and available for assistance in answering any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Birch, and I believe at this time we're going to go through the bill itself.
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, the bill itself is one section long. I didn't prepare a sectional because it's one
it's
section.
It's six lines.
And basically what this does is it amends Section 1 amends AS 15.45.240
by adding a provision, by adding subsection B, which says the provisions of an initiative are not severable after being circulated under AS 1545.110. An initiative petition may not contain a severability clause. If a court finds a provision of an initiative petition unconstitutional during a review under A of this section, the court shall order the Lieutenant Governor to reject the entire initiative petition and prohibit the placement of the initiative on the ballot.
Okay, thank you. I just think it's important to get that on the record with the number so people can listen in. And at this time, we're going to go ahead and we're discussing the possibility of some changes before, so I'm waiting on that data right now, and what we'll do is we'll go into public testimony, I think open and let them have their say on that. We'll come back and then open it up with the committee and see if we have those changes available based on timeline. So we'll kind of I'm playing this one a little bit by ear based on waiting for that data, if that's okay with you, Senator Birch.
If we can take a brief at ease.
We absolutely can. State Affairs is back on the record. Thank you, Senator Birch, for the introduction to the bill. If you guys want to go ahead and clear off the table, we're going to go into public testimony this time. And we're going to start with, hope I get this right, sir, Larry Baroskovsk. I know I got that wrong. Larry, I'm just going to say Larry. Go ahead. Do you hear us?
Yes, I do. Do you hear me?
Yes, sir. You're loud and clear. Go ahead and put yourself on the record, who you represent, and provide your testimony, and please limit it to 2 minutes.
Good. My name is Larry Barskoff, Director of Operations at the Alaska Policy Forum. Chair Dower, Vice Chair Coghill, and members of the State Affairs Committee, Senate State Affairs Committee, just to introduce myself, I earned my legal degree at Willamette University's College of Law. The right of Alaska voters to directly participate in the legislative process is a right to be cherished. It is also a right to be protected. Voters must have an absolute guarantee in the integrity of the ballot initiative process. Since 1988, and based on the McAlpine ruling, a loophole not anticipated by the writers of Alaska's Constitution and not based in statute or regulation has grown. This loophole has expanded and is now used by ballot initiative groups to rely on the state Supreme Court to act as a legal editor of ballot initiatives. Language that may not pass constitutional muster is included in ballot initiatives, and rather than removing the offending language, will be included in petition booklets. These groups know that the Supreme Court will remove the offending language later in the process. This violates the integrity of the ballot initiative process. Ensuring the integrity of the ballot initiative process should be of the highest importance. To help ensure integrity, voters casting their ballots for or against an initiative during an election should know absolutely that the language on the ballot was exactly the same as what was presented for the signature support earlier in the process. A further effect of this loophole is that the legislature can be stripped of its role to counterbalance our system. The legislature has the right to enact legislation substantially the same as proposed initiatives, thus removing those initiatives from the ballot. When initiative language is stricken or changed by the court, the legislature can lose its ability to provide oversight on the process. To prohibit the ability of a court and unelected judges to pick, choose, and delete language in a ballot initiative would require authors of initiatives to more carefully vet their language and would keep judges out of the business of crafting legislation. Not imposing a prohibition of severability robs the legislature of its right and mandate to act as a check on the initiative process by enacting legislation similar to a ballot initiative. Not imposing a prohibition on severability robs Alaska voters of the assurance that language on the ballot when they vote is the same as the language they supported during the signature gathering process. It would be good policy for this technicality to be addressed, and I urge the committee to consider how Senate Bill 80 would rectify the situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. And just to be clear, it sounds like you do support Senate Bill 80. Is that correct?
Yes, I do support the policy behind Senate Bill 80.
Thank you very much for taking the time to testify this afternoon. We're switching to Bethany Markham. Bethany, go ahead and put yourself on the record. Who you represent, provide testimony, please.
Bethany Markham, M-A-R-C-U-M, with the Alaska Policy Forum. Chair Schauer and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. Our state is indeed fortunate to have a constitutionally enshrined ballot initiative process. Not all states trust their citizens to participate directly in the legislative process. And while there are pros and cons, most Alaskans would agree that this is a valuable right. In order for the ballot initiative process to continue to have value for future generations of Alaskans, it's imperative that the integrity of our process is ensured. Currently, there is a loophole created by past Supreme Court decisions, which allows our courts to tamper with initiative language. While the intention may be good, for example, to remove unconstitutional provisions, the end result can be that the words which voters see on their ballots may in fact be different than the language which was displayed to them and other voters who earlier signed the petition booklets. Alaska experienced just this scenario in 2018 with ballot measure one. It's truly an injustice to Alaskan voters when the very words they approve for the ballot are changed by unelected judges. A further effect of this loophole is that the legislature can be stripped of its role to act as a counterbalance in the ballot initiative process. The legislature has the right to enact legislation substantially the same as proposed initiatives, thus removing those initiatives from the ballot. And when initiative language is stricken or changed by the court, the legislature effectively loses its ability to provide oversight on this process. As it stands now, initiatives can be presented to voters in the ballot box with language that is different than that which they supported with their signatures and different than the version that was reviewed by the legislature. I urge the committee to consider how Senate Bill 80 would rectify this situation. Thank you.
Bethany, thanks for calling in this afternoon. Senator Reinbold has a question for you.
So, Bethany, thank you for your input in regards to this. And I will tell you, I think I understand the concept behind this bill. What the problem, you know, so that the judges can't amend it basically to say what they want it to say, and it may be a different than what the initiative originally was intended to do. So I understand that. Where the problem I have with this is that the courts, I have not liked numerous opinions and numerous laws that they have struck down that we have worked diligently on as legislators, let alone the ballot initiatives. I understand this is not allowing them to amend, but it actually seems to me that it's increasing their power to kill initiatives. And what I've seen is that a lot of times courts use one little phrase in the Constitution and don't look at the Constitution globally. And I'll give you one example. Like, for example, I see conflicts in the Constitution where it says you can enjoy the rewards of your industry, but then it also allows the government to tax. So it can be in conflict depending on which clip of the Constitution you look at. What my problem is I don't want them, like what they did with the marriage law, to take one little clause and then strip down the Constitution, and when it was as clear as day that marriage was between one man and one woman, but then they used some clause to strike it down in the federal Constitution. It really bothers me. And so that's why my whole issue, I'm getting to the question, is does not this increase the power to courts?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I don't believe that it increases the power of the courts because, as you probably know, so many of the ballot initiatives do go through a court ruling process anyway. Most all of them have some kind of lawsuit and go through this process. So I don't believe that there would be any additional power because, as it is now, nearly every ballot initiative already has a lawsuit against it, and so the courts do end up having to rule on it in one way or another. But I don't see it really changes that. I think the solution to what you're discussing would be, for example, the Senate Joint Resolution 3 that Senator Schauer has introduced in some sort of judicial reform.
Okay.
So, good. Yeah, so there, thank you, Bethany.
All right, thanks, Bethany. We're going to switch over to Marliana Hall in Anchorage. Marliana, go ahead and put yourself on the record who you represent. 2 minutes testimony, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Schauer and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. My name is Marliana Hall. I'm the Executive Director for the Resource Development Council for Alaska. RDC, in brief, is a trade association with members in fishing, forestry, mining, oil and gas, and tourism industries, as well as the 12 land-owning Alaska Native corporations, labor, individuals, and others supporting the responsible development of Alaska's natural resources. RDC has reviewed SB 80, and I'm here today to request the members of Senate State Affairs have passed the bill out of the committee in addition to the written letter of support that I submitted earlier today. I'd like to briefly share additional points in support of why we need SB 80 in place. As you know, the voters have the ability to participate in the legislative process by either passing law or overturning law through the ballot measure process. Voters can support initiatives by writing them, signing on to them, and voting for them. Throughout these three actions, though, we feel the language should remain unchanged. Once a voter signs on in support of an initiative, that language should remain unchanged. Excuse me. SB 80 would remove the court's ability to sever the language, that way leaving that that language intact. Excuse me. Sorry. As the law is currently written, rather than ensuring that the ballot measure initiative, or excuse me, the ballot initiative language passes legal and constitutional muster before being presented to voters, we are concerned that groups will rely on Alaska's courts for legal editing services. SB 80 will send a message to proponents that the language of the initiative must be carefully drafted to ensure it is constitutional. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments today.
Thank you for calling in this afternoon, Marliana. We're going to continue on with Albert Fogel from Anchorage. Go ahead, Albert, and put yourself on the record. Who you represent? Provide 2 minutes testimony, please.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Albert Fogel, and I am the vice president of the Alaska Chamber. The Alaska Chamber is a nonprofit organization founded in 1952, working to promote a positive business environment in Alaska. We represent hundreds of businesses, manufacturers, and local chambers across the state. Our member companies employ more than 100,000 hardworking Alaskans. We believe that SB 80 is required to maintain the integrity of the signature gathering process for a ballot measure. Once a voter signs their name to a specific ballot measure language, their support should be applied only to the exact language to which they lent their name. If any court or courts decide to alter or remove language from the initiative, it cannot be assumed that voter support remains. Should a court sever language from a proposed ballot measure, it should be mandatory that initiative proponents go back and ask voters to support the revised language that would be actually appear on the ballot. As such, we support this legislation and applaud your effort to correct a deficiency that has been overlooked in the ballot initiative process. We also believe SB 80 will result in fewer protracted legal battles once ballot measure proponents understand that should any section of their initiative not pass constitutional muster, they would be required to revert to the signature gathering stage of the process. This should result in more carefully crafted ballot measures being proposed at the outset, which means a smoother, more predictable process for all parties, whether they support or oppose the ballot measure in question. So in summary, we support SB 80 and appreciate the opportunity to represent our membership's view on this important topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Albert, for taking time to call in this afternoon. We're going to switch over this time to Eric Felstad from Anchorage. Go ahead and put yourself on the record and provide testimony, please.
Hi, Eric Felstad here. I'm an attorney in Anchorage, and I've worked around ballot measure initiatives over the last probably 10 years. I agree with everything that's been said so far. There's kind of three things that settle out here. First is truth in advertising. From the voter perspective, if you sign a pamphlet, you are looking at language, and you shouldn't be in a position where that language is changed later. But the second point is the really one I want to focus on, which is the constitutional issue here, which is the Constitution puts the power in the legislature as the last stop, so to speak, on initiatives. There's the ability to cut off an initiative by enacting something that's substantially similar. And that's a really important safeguard here. And what you have happening, and it happened in last fall with the Salmon Initiative, is the court struck major provisions of the initiative and then sent that on to the voters. And the key takeaway is that version that was modified by the court is very different than what the legislature had the chance to look at initially. And I would argue that the dynamics are entirely different after something's been modified by the court. Frankly, it's the sort of situation the legislature might actually choose to get involved with. You can say, if something's really bad, what's the chance you're going to enact something substantially similar? If the bad stuff's been taken out, the odds go way up that you would actually take action. So this matters. This is a balance of power issue. I see it as between the legislature and the courts. And I think it's the rightful place of the legislature to make clear that, you know, this is its prerogative, not the courts. I see this as an apolitical issue, and it doesn't matter what the nature of the ballot measure is. This would apply equally to any ballot measure. And then the last point is to emphasize what others have said. The dynamic right now, what the court has done with the last ruling, is it's going to encourage all sorts of bad behavior on initiative proponents. There's no reason not to overreach and draft things that would be unconstitutional because you know the courts are there to save you in the end. So there will be more overreaching, knowing that the courts are going to fix it. So I support this measure. I think it makes good common sense and restores the balance of powers as the architects of the Constitution intended. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric, for taking the time to call in this afternoon. I don't see anybody else online at this time. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on Senate Bill 80? Go ahead, going to go ahead and close public testimony at this time. We're going to go ahead and take a brief at ease here for a moment. Senate State Affairs is back on the record. I've invited the sponsor of the bill back up with his staff at this time. Since we went a little out of order waiting on the data, we're going to go back to the normal flow at this point, which is back to allowing the committee to ask questions, and we'll dig into the bill from a policy perspective. So at this time, Senator Birch, if you and your staff put yourself back on the record, and we're going to open the committee for questions.
Yeah, Chris Birch, Senate District M, South Anchorage.
Kim Skipper, staff to Senator Birch, District M.
Thank you very much. All right, committee, who has questions? Starting with... Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a handful of questions on the, you know, the purpose of this is to maybe restrict the total number of ballot measures that actually have to go to the voters because the legislature can do it. I guess, how many ballot measures have we had in the last 10 years that have gone to voters?
Through the chair, the intent is not to restrict the number of ballot measures that come before the voters. The intent is that if the courts rewrite a ballot measure that was signed by, you know, 40,000 people in front of REI over some protracted period of time, that the language in the, you know, four or five pages of ballot measure description that they approved or signed for, if that gets substantially changed by the courts and severed by the courts, that it needs to go back and start over. In other words, the language needs to be constitutional from the get-go.
Yeah, Senator Kawasaki, follow up. I think he also had asked about number, too.
I was just curious how many ballot measures had actually gone to the people in the last 10 years.
We can probably get that for you.
You just brought up when the court severed certain parts, and you mentioned the word substantially. What does that term mean to you?
The term
of art.
Yeah, I'm an engineer and not an attorney, but the severability would relate to the constitutional aspects. In other words, if it's revised in a manner that to make the actual ballot question constitutional, then it changes substantially from what the original signer had started with.
And
through the chair.
Follow-up, Senator Kovacevic.
Thank you. And, you know, the use of severability clauses are fairly common. We've got them in just about every bill we've seen so far, either in judiciary for sure, but definitely. Why do you think that's necessary?
I don't think it's necessary. That's why I'm proposing to remove it.
Okay, so why? I mean, I guess why do you think, through the chair, it's necessary to remove the severability clauses for laws that are appearing before the people versus laws that would appear before the legislature?
Through the chair, I think the issue is the amount of effort, energy, and initiative that it takes to put a properly constructed ballot measure together and gather those signatures. I think it needs to be done right the first time.
Senator Kawasaki.
A handful of other questions. Just if you get back to me on the total number of ballot measures that we've had in the last 10 years or so, and then how often is an initiative later challenged, if you know that?
We'll get back to you with that as well. Yeah, I don't know. I just followed this one.
Senator Kawasaki, I know you had a couple more questions. Just go, as opposed to taking the time there, just keep asking them until you get to the bottom of your list. Make it a little faster.
Just generally, I'm just wondering more about the generation of the bill and how this will have an effect on basically, I mean, a very fundamental constitutional right of initiative and referendum. And so I just have comments around those or questions around those. And then secondly, just on the timeline, I recognize that there's a timeline issue. Did you try to look at a way to correct the timeline, the total number of days perhaps when it takes to that the lieutenant governor has to certify and then the petitioners have a certain number, 30 days after? Did you try and look at a different way like that would be more amenable to petitioners, basically?
Through the chair, I think once the signatures gathering begins, I think the expectation would be that you're dealing with a document that has been constitutionally vetted, and that when you get through the signature gathering phase and it ends up on the ballot, that it doesn't substantially change in form and in content from what was signed to what was actually voted on. Through the chair.
Good for that.
Thanks. Senator Coghill.
How many have been changed by the court after vetting? Because I think what was last asked was there's a vetting process, but the reality is as the vetting happens, then even after the vote, they might be taken to court, but certainly prior to the vote, many have been taken. How many have actually been changed after the vetting process, before the voting process?
Through the chair, we didn't undertake a research project to proceed with this. So, you know, I mean, I'm certain we can get access to that information. But as far as, you know, looking back historically to see, you know, how pervasive this issue was, you know, I'm sure that information is available, and we'll get that for you.
Mr. Chairman,
through the chair.
Follow-up, Senator Cox.
As this goes forward, and I'm okay, I think the concept is right, so I'm not going to stand in the way of the concept. But these are questions that you're going to have to go through kind of the labyrinth to get this to the finish line, I think. So it's going to be important that I know one of the most recent ones had been changed with a constitutional tweak, and so I know that happens. It's just that we just know how many times it happens. And I think you can demonstrate pretty easily why this needs to be fixed. I think the people of Alaska, I mean, we have the same restrictions on us, by the way. Many times we have had, and I have been a participant in many of them that went all the way to the Supreme Court, got slapped down. They're still on the books, but they're invalid. So to then go to the people and say you can get part of the law and it's not invalid when the legislature quite often gets slapped down entirely. So I think this is a good concept. It's just that we need to prove the track record on this, I think.
Good counsel.
Thanks, Senator Coghill. Senator Rumble.
So my question, Senator Birch, if you know the answer to this question, and I believe I know the answer, but I really want to know this. When a court decides to strike down an initiative, do they have to specifically identify where in the Constitution, or can they just say, you know, in general, you know, this clause? Or do they have to be pretty specific on exactly why they rule that, strike it down.
If, you know, I might defer as the engineer in the room to the attorney that may be online. If Mr. Felstad is still listening, perhaps he could address that, Mr. Chairman.
Eric, are you still online with us?
Yeah, I'm here. I can answer that. The court would identify a specific constitutional provision. In the last case, it was last fall, they identified the appropriations clause. And so they found that multiple provisions of the ballot measure one violated the appropriations clause. They struck those, they so-called severed those from the initiative, and then the remainder moved forward. I can also address, I think, the question of how many times this has come up. I think it's in the handful category, you know, less than five probably is my sense over time.
Follow-up, Senator Amel.
Okay, so that is helpful. However, like I said earlier on record, sometimes, you know, there's different things in the Constitution. For example, it defined a man and woman, clear as day. But then, you know, they went to a different clause, even though it was clearly written, and decided to strike it down. Same thing with being able to enjoy the rewards of your own industry in the very beginning of the Constitution. Later it says that you can tax. So I guess to me, you probably can't answer this question. And by the way, hi, Eric. I appreciate you being online today. I wanted to say, do they have to look at the Constitution globally, or can they just strike it down, you know, just based on one clause that they decide to interpret it on at that moment?
Well, the way it would work in litigation is so they would be focused on the arguments that the parties, this is at least most of the time, that the arguments that the parties make. And so they ultimately will have to find a specific constitutional provision to strike it down. And most of the time they're focused on what the parties argue rather than finding authority kind of on their own.
Through the chair, my question was, to me it seems like they should have to look, you know, at the entire Constitution globally rather than just a little provision, because I do believe that there's areas, you know, almost anything can be argued with each and every clause, you know, in the Constitution. And that's why my question was, do they have to look at the Constitution globally? It sounds like the answer is no, that they can just go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's fair. The answer is no. I mean, courts will do what courts do, I guess, is the caveat. So there's no hard and fast rule. But generally, they're looking at whatever arguments the parties put in front of them. So if the parties argue three constitutional provisions, they're squared off on three provisions. Generally, the court will look at those three and not look at everything else.
Good. Okay, thank you, Eric. And through the chair, is this time to make comments?
Yeah, go ahead, Senator Ramble.
Okay, so I'm basically just going to get my comments on record. I'm a huge supporter of the initiative process and the power belonging to the people, so I absolutely support that. I think it's just brilliant in the Constitution. What I want to do, and I wish I could, and I don't think I can right now, but make the courts look at the entire Constitution globally intact. And I feel like so many times they have just struck so many awesome things down by a little clause, and I think inappropriate in many, many cases. Basically, I just want to say, with me voting to get this, if we're voting, I don't know if we're voting to get this out of committee, but assuming that we're going to allow this out of committee at some point, I just want to make sure that it's noted that I don't want to increase the power of the courts at all. I mean, that is not the intention. I think they're way too powerful as it is right now, and I think the power, you know, really should belong with the people. And so as long as this does not empower the courts more, that it's power that they already assume, and that they would absolutely be required to specify with as much detail as possible why they strike things down. I just think that that's really, really important. But the concept, I think, is a really good concept. And thank you for bringing it forth.
Thank you very much,
Senator Machicki.
Thank you. Hello, Eric. There was a comment made about referendum, but looking at this section of law, I believe this bill is only dealing with initiatives. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. No, you didn't. Mr. Chairman, I just have a couple comments. I support this, and I'll tell you the reasons why. And I see it as being completely nonpartisan. My wife and I gathered signatures for parental consent. And I would have rather known that it was unconstitutional in advance, and perhaps we could have presented it a different way with a new application as opposed to wasting all that time and waiting for a year and a half for the ruling. And then when you look at the fish initiative process, without this, if I were writing an initiative today, I would shoot for the moon. I would go for the most extreme stance that I could possibly land, and I would let the courts fix it for me, which is what occurred. So I think it's disingenuous for those that are lending their name to the signature process, and I think it could be a time saver, and I'm a huge supporter, like probably everyone here, of the initiative process. When folks feel like we're not doing our jobs, they have the ability to make laws and to repeal laws through the referendum process, and I support that, but I would like for that. I think this puts more pressure on the courts to determine constitutionality in advance so that perhaps people on either side can come back with something that's likely constitutional, collect their signatures, and put it on the ballot. So I think it's a time saver. I think it's the right thing to do, and I think it avoids the courts rewriting initiatives differently than they've been proposed. So I thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Kawasaki.
I'll pass.
Pass. Senator Ramble.
I just can't help myself. I just want to say I was out there. It was freezing cold collecting signatures. And I tell you, I was ticked off when it got struck down, too. So I just wanted to reiterate Senator McChickie's comments. And then it also really upset me when the court struck down a law that we worked on for 2 years based on nothing, in my opinion, you know, in regards to restricting abortions. And I think that they are way out of hand, and that's why I want to make sure, you know, the courts and their opinions, I think they put tremendous bias into their many of their opinions. And so that's why I definitely think this is a really good that once it's been circulated, it says it can't be because they looked at it ahead of time. So actually, the more I read this, the more I like it. So anyway, I just want to make sure I got that on record. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator Ramble. We're going to take a brief at ease here a moment. Just Senate State Affairs back on the record. We have, at this time, we're just going to ask for any further questions or comments from the committee. Okay. Senator Coghill.
Only a comment in that since I won't be able to hear this in the next committee, that the questions I asked are brought forward and get on the record, if you don't mind. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go ahead and make a motion to move the bill.
Just before you do that, Senator Coghill, so I didn't forget, if anyone missed public testimony today, you can go ahead and submit it to the as always, you can submit it in writing, senate.state@affairs.kleg.gov. It will be uploaded to the public record. At that point, Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, was there an objection in the past? I don't know.
There was not.
Okay, that's all I needed to know.
That's correct. That's why we made sure that we're clear before we go. Okay, Senator Coghill, please.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the State Affairs Committee move Senate Bill 80, version U, from committee with individual recommendations attached. I think it's got a
it has a zero
fiscal note.
That's correct.
With the individual recommendations, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any objections? Seeing and hearing none, Senate Bill 80 moves from committee. We're going to take an Addies to sign the paperwork. Senate State Affairs back on the record. We're going to continue at this time, bring it back up, Senate Bill 32, Crime Sentencing, Mental Illness, and Evidence. The committee last heard this bill on Tuesday, April 9th. We're going to get a more in-depth look as we continue to dig on SB 32. We have several other entities that are going to be with us today for answering questions. We have James Stinson, Director of Public Advocacy. We've got Robert Henderson, Department of Law. We have several from DPS, including Ms. Monfrida for the director of DPS and Quinlan Steiner for the Public Defender Agency. So we have a number of folks that are online to answer questions as we get back into it. And we're going to start with, I believe, we had some questions for DPS from last time, but we'll just get moving as we need to based on the questions. So at this time, it's open to the committee. Who would like to start?
With DPS?
If whoever you like, there was just minimum questions there, so if you want to start that way.
I guess I'll start with DPS.
Go ahead. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the latitude here. And this, I guess, could be for whomever wants to answer, but the one of the parts of the bill deals with the DNA swabs at time of arrest. I don't have that actually in front of me. Wondering what the thought was behind that, and then I have follow-up questions after that.
So I'm just going to open it up to whoever is online that would like to take that question.
This is Catherine Monfrida from Public Safety. I think I can answer that question.
And just one thing, Kathy, before we get started, for all those online listening, because we're going to be switching potentially with multiple folks, every time you come back on, could you just very briefly say who you are and who you're with so that the record keepers can stay with you, please? And, Kathy, go ahead. Thanks.
For the record, my name is Catherine Monfrida. I'm the Director of Statewide Services for the Department of Public Safety. Through the Chair, Senator Kawasaki, the law requiring the collection of DNA at the time of arrest was passed in 2007, so it's currently part of the law. It was a lobbying effort by Karen Foster, who was the mother of Bonnie Craig, who was very passionate about it. Senator Wilkowski introduced the amendment to a bill, and the power behind it was that had the law been in effect to allow for the collection of DNA at the time of arrest, that murder would have been happened, but could have been cured, solved 12 years earlier.
Follow up.
Yes. This is a person's first time offense, being arrested for any sort of crime, and now the penalty for not providing DNA at the time of arrest will be a Class A misdemeanor. Was there a penalty before that?
For the record, this is Catherine Monfrida, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. Currently, it is not a crime to refuse to submit a DNA sample at the time of arrest. And it's not for every arrest. It's for only felony arrests.
Through the chair. And then just following up, so DNA at the time of arrest, currently, if a person's DNA is checked or taken, what happens to that DNA? Where is it stored? Is it analyzed at the time of arrest? What happens if the person is later just, I guess, just not does not go through arraignment or is released? What happens in those circumstances?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, the current law requires that if a person is not found guilty, that they could request a court order to have the sample destroyed. And that is what currently happens today. The samples are taken and they're analyzed and entered into a system called CODIS, which is a system run by the FBI. It's in an encrypted private network that is not accessible for many reasons, many aspects. There's no state-controlled computers that are allowed to be attached to it, so there's very little risk of being hacked. And once a person requests that their sample be destroyed and the court order is issued, the crime lab gets a copy of the court order. They destroy the sample with a witness. They document the destruction, and they notify the court and the attorney or defendant that sample has been destroyed.
So just one more follow-up then. So if Senator Reinbold and I get into a little scuffle today after session, and we both get we both have a disorderly conduct charge against us, we get hauled off, and we were arrested for disorderly conduct, we would, if the law were in place now, have to submit to a buccal swab, and that buccal swab would then be uploaded to CODIS automatically. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, this is Deputy Commissioner Michael Duxbury. Sir, that would be a misdemeanor, and that would not be one of the applicable situations in this situation. It has to be a felony. It has to be a serious crime, person-on-person crime, for us to take the sample.
Follow up. Go ahead.
So just one clarification. Does it have to be a crime against a person, or does it? What's considered a serious felony? Could it be a property crime? That's a serious property crime, or could it just, or does it have to have an element of force?
Through the chair, Senator Showers, I think that might be a better question for the Department of Law and Mr. Henderson to answer, so it is positive.
For the record, this is Robert Henderson, Deputy Attorney General for the State of Alaska Department of Law Criminal Division. So, through the chair, Senator, your question was about disorderly conduct. Deputy Commissioner Duxbury is correct. That would not be a qualifying offense under the law, and it's AS 44-41-035 sub B. It says the crimes that are covered, a person who is arrested for a crime against a person, so that's your 1141 offenses, or a felony under Title 11 or Title 28, so that's all felonies and your felony DUIs. Those are the types of offenses that would be covered.
Okay, so copy that. And I've got a question for Fargo Senator Reinbold. She had a question as well, just very briefly, but I do have to make a comment. I think it is more likely that the scuffle, based on my historical observations here, would be between Senator Reinbold and Senator Coghill, not Senator Kawasaki. I'm just saying it for the record. Again, back to the humor, late in the session kind of day, even though it's not Friday yet. When it is destroyed, and back to whoever wants to answer this question, once it's in the system, is that data still, because, you know, truly when you put something into the digital world, it's never really gone. So is that data still stored, for example, in the federal facility in Utah that stores everything for the next 100 years, every electronic transmission, phone call, email, et cetera? And I'm asking that because, again, as I said, I would dig into the DNA side and then the personal privacy. What evidence or proof, I guess, is there that data actually truly is gone and cannot ever be retrieved or used again to protect somebody's privacy, especially assuming, for example, they don't get convicted?
For the record, Senator Showers. This is Catherine Monfreda. It's my understanding that the data is destroyed. It's removed from the computerized CODA system and is not accessible for any purpose.
Okay, that's a good answer for the record. The reality is it's probably out there somewhere, and we can talk more about that, but that's really not germane to the discussion today. There's nothing we can do about that here. Senator Reinbold?
Okay, so I do want to make a comment on the disorderly conduct, but I'm actually going to refrain because I have some really important stuff to ask you. So I'm really glad that there's bookends in regards to collecting the DNA sample of what Mr. Duxbury and Mr. Henderson spoke to. What my question is, at what point is a DNA sample required? Because I believe it's a conviction, but I'm not positive. If you could clarify that, that would be helpful.
So for the record, Robert Henderson, Department of Law. So through the chair, Senator, the types of offenses and the circumstances in which DNA is required is spelled out by statute. It is if a person, again, I'm looking for the record at AS 4441035, and it's actually sub B. First off, it's a person convicted in this state of a crime against a person, so that's your 1141 violent offenses, or a felony under Title 11, or AS 2835, that's your felony DUI, or law with elements similar to crimes against a person or a felony. And then subsection 2 would be a minor adjudicated as a delinquent if the minor was 16 years of age or older and they committed a crime against a person or a felony. Subsection 3 is a voluntary donor. Subsection 4 is an anonymous DNA donor that's used for forensic validation. Sub 5 is a person required to register as a sex offender or child kidnapper under Title 12. And then finally, sub 6, which is what we're talking about in SB 32, a person arrested for those crimes that I previously described, which is a crime against a person under Title 1141, a felony under Title 11, or a felony under Title 2835.
Follow up.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess I have a question in general, and thank you. You guys are extremely knowledgeable. You know about fingerprints and DNA sampling and things like that. But I'm going to put that on hold just for a moment, because basically what I want to ask you is if someone is convicted of a vehicle theft or a burglary or even a purse snatching, would they have to at this point, as the current law states, be required to give any sort of DNA samples?
Through the chair, Senator, it depends on the type of offense they're convicted of, but a person who's convicted of, say, a burglary, that's a felony offense, they would be required to submit to a DNA sample. If they're convicted of a felony-level theft, they would be required to provide a DNA sample upon conviction. Purse snatching, depending on how it is ultimately charged and convicted, if it's a theft against a person from a person under a theft in the second degree, that would be a C felony.
So okay,
that would be covered.
Okay, so I guess where I'm going with this is you keep saying at conviction, and I'm the reason why I really support I generally support the concept of getting more DNA sampling to help reduce wrongful convictions, help get to a verdict quicker, to help reduce pretrial delays, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the reason why I'm leaning toward what's going on with Senate Bill 32, as long as I know that there are some parameters, in relation to SB 32. And can you state the parameters in SB 32 with the swab, or will it be every arrest in SB 32?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, it's for any arrest that's a felony or any crime against a person or any felony DUI. Those are your three big categories. So if anybody's arrested for those type of offenses, their DNA is going to be collected. and put into the system. And you're absolutely right, Senator. It's a very powerful, very effective law enforcement tool that Ms. Monfreda described initially with her testimony. And I will tell you that there are several safeguards or sideboards on the information that's being collected. We've talked about a couple of them. I will also, just for the record, let you know that federal law also imposes a $250,000 fine or up to a year in jail for any unauthorized disclosure of information that's in the CODIS system. So that's another safeguard that's in place.
One more.
Okay, and through the chair, he's allowed me to be one more question, so I'm going to ask two in one. But basically, is there any correlation with fingerprints and DNA? I am not an expert in that area, and are you allowed to, you know, collect fingerprints, or would that be part of a warrant? And the second question, if they do take a swab under the Senate Bill 32, and let's say they're not convicted, will they still be able to use the court rule to get it dismissed, to get the sample and all the records from their fingerprints, like you talked about a few minutes ago, destroyed?
Through the chair, Senator, if a person is not convicted or if charges aren't filed, if somebody's arrested and charges are referred to our office and we make the determination, for the record, our office, meaning the Department of Law, if we make the determination that charges are unwarranted, then that person can have that DNA that was previously seized, destroyed, and not put into CODIS. If the person is ultimately acquitted of the charge, the same process would apply, that they could have that removed. Your second question was about fingerprinting. Can you restate your question?
The chair said yes. That was a little sneaky. I get it. But is it fingerprints? Are they allowed? Are you guys allowed to get them? You know, when you're arresting, and also, is there any correlation with fingerprints and DNA, or is it two totally separate issues? I'm just trying to help get the right people convicted. That's where I'm going with this.
Through the chair, Senator Rembold. So the Constitution allows the police to take certain routine administrative steps during processing or booking, and that includes biographical information, name, date of birth, address, photographing, fingerprinting, and if it's one of the qualifying offense, the buccal swab to capture that DNA.
Okay, we're going to continue to move, but I'm going to ask that the Department of Public Safety, whoever is the appropriate one, would like to get back. I'd like to hear about those safeguards in an email that kind of spells them out clearly, so that the committee and then when we go to judiciary, we'll know exactly what those bookends are. I would also like to know about if there's any other states that have had this type of provision, and whether there were any constitutional or otherwise, legal challenges as we go into, because we're not seeing judiciary next. So I'd like to know before we let this move on, if there's other states that have had issues. So if somebody could please provide those answers back to me, I would appreciate it. And I'm going to ask for that just written for now, just so that we can continue to move on. There are some other questions and some other agencies here that have different questions, so I'd like to get to those. So, Senator Coghill?
No, I actually have to leave, so
do you want
my
to just
apologies.
Try to pick that up on Tuesday for your other question? Okay, copy that. And I know that we had the public defender was here, the same kind of question on the DNA. So I would actually like to see if Mr. Steiner, if you'd like to come on and just comment about, from the public defender aspect, the other side, as I like to ask, of any kind of a debate, get it from both ends of the spectrum. So could you comment on anything you're aware of regarding personal privacy, constitutional issues, et cetera, with the proposals in Senate Bill 32 regarding DNA collection, use, destruction, et cetera?
Through the chair, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. I think the issue that's presented here is, in part, is that the crime occurs right at arrest. So somebody's arrested, and formerly it wasn't a crime, and now it's a crime. It actually could elevate the situation fairly significantly because it covers all 1141 crimes, which includes misdemeanor assaults and the most the lowest level of crimes against a person will be included. You'd have a crime flow from that. And I don't know how that would relate to the dismissal of the charges. You could be convicted of the crime of failing to provide and acquitted, or they might not even file charges against the original low-level fear assault that could be really stemming from just an argument. A disorderly conduct may not apply, but certainly placing somebody in fear of physical injury. And physical injury is, however slight, it can be very low level. Arguments can develop into fear assaults with a raised fist and a bar. And they don't go anywhere often, but that could result in the conviction of somebody for failing to supply that. And then they'd affirmatively have to seek its destruction, which it doesn't happen automatically. It's a whole other process that that person who may not be in a position to pursue it would have to pursue it. And while that exists now, this sort of elevates the whole thing to a level that might not be what you'd want. Convictions and then ultimate destruction for having failed to provide it in the first place if it's later taken for another crime.
I'm going to ask Mr. Henderson to come back on and play you guys off of each other here just for a bit to kind of see if we can figure out where the who says well, it's always interesting to watch lawyers argue from both sides of the equation, but you can learn from that. So, Mr. Henderson, could you counter, or if you have a counter or other information, or do you agree with the public defender's data there as far as the lowest level charges? And I'm going to ask it this way as you answer. As well, if you took a sample after arrest, somebody wasn't convicted, DNA provided a hit on another crime, would that evidence also be admissible as you're looking through this? So I'm asking multiple questions, but I think we're all, you can see for everybody listening, we're concerned about, you know, obviously using data appropriately, making sure it's protected constitutionally, and we're not violating rights. So, Mr. Henderson?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Robert Henderson for the Department of Law. So I guess what I would say is that an argument can lead to a misdemeanor assault in the fourth degree, but it has to be more than just an argument. It has to be recklessly placing somebody in fear of physical injury. So there has to be some affirmative step, and that's why how we distinguish between disorderly conduct, which is not an 1141 crime. Now, I will say that if that DNA is taken and it's taken in good faith by law enforcement and by the lab, and it ultimately turns up to be a hit, and that person is a suspect in another crime, that evidence is unlikely to be the match, the DNA connection is unlikely to be suppressed if the officers were operating in good faith. And that scenario is actually talked about in the statute itself. The person has to affirmatively refuse to provide, and so it does create a new crime. But it actually, in my professional judgment, would actually encourage people to submit to that DNA sample when they're otherwise required to do so. The person is required by law to submit to that DNA, and by the officer being able to say, "You need to do this, or you're going to get charged with a new crime," that will encourage the person to comply with the pre-existing current state of the law. And that's what we're missing right now. We're just missing that incentive.
Okay. Is that true, though, I guess you did say that was true, that the lowest level crime, you could have that. That's a bit concerning to me, depending on how big of a hammer we want to wield, depending on the level of the accused crime. So trying to find the balance here between those. And just to be clear, Ms. Manfreda, I didn't hear anybody affirmatively answer to get some of these questions back in writing from somebody, and I'm open to whoever that is, but as far as getting the bookends, et cetera, on whether how it's destroyed, et cetera, guarantee that it's destroyed, and I think also might not have gotten a solid answer on Senator Reinbold's question of if somebody is arrested versus convicted, is it did you get a solid answer on that? I'm not sure I got that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead.
This is Quinlan Steiner with the Public Defender again. I would just like to point out one potential that might delay the process in doing this. In the context of a DUI, when you're required to provide a blood or a breath sample, your refusal entitles you with the opportunity to talk to a lawyer before you refuse. If this went through, this would certainly raise that prospect because you could be charged with a crime at arrest, and that can be a substantial time process to engage a lawyer right there on the spot before you actually refuse. You have the right to consult. In that DUI scenario, that may extend to this process as well.
And I would add, if Mr. Henderson, you're welcome to respond to that, but what that goes a little bit in line with one of my questions. Have other states enacted something similar, and have there been constitutional or otherwise legal challenges to similar provisions? Because I am concerned, depending on how far this is taken, like I said before, when I read this bill, this was one of the first things that jumped out at me. Are we setting ourselves up for potential challenges like that? So anybody that would like to answer, go ahead.
Through the chair, this is Robert Henderson, or to the chair, excuse me, Robert Henderson, Department of Law. So a couple things on that. Alaska is not unique in this system. All 50 states use CODIS, the Combined DNA Index System, that is maintained and serviced by the FBI. 31 states as of 2018, 31 states have DNA collection laws at the time of arrest. Most states define what is a qualifying offense differently. I will tell you that there have been legal challenges in some states, and the states that I reviewed this morning, when those legal challenges have been made as to a misdemeanor arrest as a qualifying offense, those challenges have not been successful. The U.S. Supreme Court has definitively held that it's not a violation of the Fourth Amendment to collect someone's DNA upon arrest if they're charged with a serious offense. Then the question becomes, what is the definition of serious offense? And that's, frankly, what the lower courts are struggling with now, and that's what they're interpreting right now, is what does the Supreme Court mean when it says a serious offense? And there have been other states that have upheld misdemeanor violent offenses as qualifying offenses for purposes of a serious offense.
Okay. Ms. Monfredi, just to be clear, did you get that request for that information back in writing on the bookends, if you will, the guardrails, whatever you want to call the buzzwords here, as far as late in the day, brain's getting tired, for SB 32 and those kind of constitutional protections, privacy protections for citizens?
To the chair, for the record, this is Catherine Monfredi again. Yes, I will coordinate with our lab DNA people and get in writing the safeguard steps.
Okay, thank you. Continuing. Have your question? Thank you, Dan. We're getting close. I'm willing to go just a couple more minutes because we were delayed there. But
I just wanted to throw a couple questions out there that aren't on the written one.
Go ahead.
Just a couple questions.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry. I think this is probably directed toward the probably the Department of Law regarding the language surrounding terroristic threatening. And if somebody just wants to call me on offline, I guess, and get some clarification on that, I've got a little concern about the way it's written. And then another question is probably for law enforcement regarding the Title 47 process and the request for the Department of Public Safety to receive all records of a person who's adjudicated of a mental illness or a mental incompetence issued on or after October 1st, 1981. There's some questions regarding that, and due process, and then I'll just list it out right now. What we got from the Department of Public, our Department of Ledge Legal, that there might be some potential due process issues for people who were committed crimes prior to 2014 under the Brady Handgun Bill. It says it's illegal to dispose of or sell a firearm ammunition to any individual who's been adjudicated of a mental defect or has been committed to a mental institution. So I had some concerns with that, and I think that there are concerns that have been raised by our legal services. And so if there's somebody that can also maybe get back to us with that, that would be great.
Thanks, Senator Kawasaki. Just for those that were listening with his questions, if you have
in order. We'll start with Department of Law and then basically DPS. Is anyone available or basically say you can get those questions back to us in writing? I'll start with you, Mr. Henderson.
So, Mr. Chairman, Robert Henderson, for the record, yes, we can get those answers to the committee members. That shouldn't be a problem.
Thank you. And Ms. Monfreda, same for you.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay.
For the record, this is Catherine.
Sorry. Thanks, Kathy. I apologize. I cut you off. And then Mr. Steiner, same thing from Public Defender. If you had anything to add, if you could get those back as well, please.
Certainly.
Okay. Senator Ryan, we'll go ahead. We're going to have one or two more things, and I'll wrap it up for the time today.
Okay. So through the chair, Mr. Henderson said it was basically a very powerful tool for whodunit with the DNA, and that's why I think it's and I see that there's bookends, and I think that's really, really important. There's provisions to get it destroyed if it's a wrongful conviction or if it is a non-conviction at all, or if you drop the case. So I think that's really good. There's a $250,000 fine for misuse of this information, which I think is very, very important. What my question is, and I'm going to pose this both to Quinlan and to Rob, and I've got one more question after this. Do you see how this could help ensure that wrongful convictions do not take place? And if you could do a yes or no answer, both Quinlan and Rob, I would appreciate that because I know we're over time right now.
So, for the record, this is Rob Henderson. The short answer to your question, Senator, is yes. I think, actually, that there may be an example of something like that happening in another state, and I can look for that answer.
Okay.
Quinlan?
Quinlan, go ahead.
This is Quinlan Steiner, public defender. I do think there's may have been instances, and that is certainly a theoretical possibility, that the collection of this could then be tied to a case, assuming that information would still be available and there'd be a hit. But I don't know that would be the case. If a closed case with a conviction, they may not still be looking for it. I wouldn't have the answer to that because I don't understand how they close out these files. Right. But theoretically, it's possible.
Okay. So Quinlan, basically, this was just strictly a question in regards to by collecting DNA samples for these people that have committed these certain felony level and other crimes that are listed, to basically allow for an absolute clarity in convictions, because it's a very powerful tool. You, I'm sure, don't want to get the wrong guy in or gal in jail. And that's basically what I was saying. This could be a very powerful tool for the defendant as well to ensure that the wrong people aren't ending up in jail. And this to me is just as good of an amendment for wrongful convictions or convictions. It could help the defendant or, on either side is basically what I'm saying. And that's basically just to ensure that there's not wrongful conviction so that the DNA sample is there. So, I mean, to me it's obvious that this would help that situation.
That would be dependent upon whether or not those closed cases are still in the system for which when a new sample of DNA came in that it would tie them together. And that's the question I don't know the answer to. Whether or not that's true, whether or not those cases stay in the system once they've been closed.
Senator Ramel, follow up.
Basically, I think you're confusing issues here, so I'm going to move on. But bottom line is Catherine Monfredo.
Not confusing the issue, actually, but thank you.
It was a very simple, direct question. We're not talking about closed cases at all, so I have no idea where you're going with that at this point.
That's what a false conviction is. When somebody gets convicted, the case is closed with a conviction and potentially appeal. They can be closed for a long time.
Okay, and through the chair, I'm talking about convictions as well. This is to prevent wrongful convictions, prevention. That's what I was talking about. So to me, it's very obvious. I don't really need an answer from you in regards to this. Basically, Catherine Monfredo, I'm going to ask you, I know we ask you on record for this, and I know we're rushing the process, but it's very, very important for this bill to get the information of the 2018. I know you're working on that, but the offenses that happened, if you could get that to us sooner rather than later, I think that that's a really powerful tool that we need as we're dealing with criminal law rewrite. So just want to put that on the record, Mr. Chairman.
Copy that. Thank you, Senator Reinbold. We are a bit over, so... powerful tools are important, and they can be used for good. They can also be used for bad, and I think that's part of the balance we need to be striking here is if we go too far, then perhaps we need to rein it back in, and that's what I'm looking at. I have the same questions. We didn't get to it today for time. Senator Kawasaki does about the terroristic threat, so I said I would ask you today. I'm going to go ahead and ask it on Tuesday, and Tuesday will be almost the entire time dedicated to this bill. The intent, just again, for the committee members and the public is to know by hopefully next Thursday. If we can get through it, we'll have amendments and we'll try to move this bill to finance to see what we can do by the end of the session at that time. So expect to come back for everybody that was online and those in the room. Thanks for taking your time to be here. I know we didn't get to everyone and we have a long ways to go. So I appreciate your time and your patience. We're going to go ahead and set the bill aside for now. Concludes our business for today. Senate State Affairs will be meeting again on Monday, April 15, 2019 at 6 p.m. back in this room for public testimony on Senate Bill 32, Crime Sentencing, Mental Illness, and Evidence. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 5:08 p.m.